Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming here and listening to me. No, I was invited by the organizers to give you an overview talk over gauge string duality, or ADS-CFT, as I'll refer to it in the rest of my talk. And so I'll try to summarize in 40 minutes, you know, what this field can do for you, what has happened in the last year, a little bit how to do calculation, a little bit about my own work. So I hope that's not going to be too ambitious, and we all going to get something out of this. So what is ADS-CFT? Now, the way to think about it, at least in the context of this conference, what it provides for you, what ADS-CFT really is, it's a solvable toy model of non-equilibrium strong coupling dynamics. So it's really a class of toy models. And the basic buzzword is that you can, in these toy models, finite temperature field theory is dual, has a dual description in terms of classical gravity with a black hole. So why is this a good thing? Why do we need toy models? Well, we're trying to address one of the hardest problems in physics. We want to look at non-equilibrium, so real-time dynamics, in a strongly coupled system. So because it's strongly coupled, we can't do perturbation theory. Because it's real-time dynamics, we have problems on the lattice, and we can do a few things, but you know, it's really not that easy. And so it might be nice to at least have a toy model where we can do both of those things, even though it's not necessarily realistic. Well, there's one thing that does work. So why do I need a toy model? I can do low-energy effective theory. That I can still do. Now, in the context of non-equilibrium dynamics, that's called hydrodynamics, where you're looking at a description that is valid for wavelengths which are much larger than your microscopic scale. And then you just do the usual low-energy effective theory game. You write down the power series and derivatives. You expand the power series of derivatives. You put in some arbitrary pre-factors. You write down the most general term consistent with symmetries. And then you introduce some low-energy constants, which are the transport coefficients. And in many ways, a strong coupling effective theory is even more effective than a weak coupling, because the range at which it's applicable is much larger. At weak coupling, you can only use hydrodynamics if you're above basically the mean free path of your particles, which has 1 over t squared in there. Strong coupling, the only relevant scale is the temperature. So you expect in a strongly coupled theory hydrodynamics to be great. No, let me just run through the one simple example, how this framework looks. Now, if you look at the dynamics of a current, that's really the easiest thing to do hydrodynamics of. Now, if you want to write down effective theory, low-energy effective theory, the first thing you have to do is identify what are the right degrees of freedom. Like the pions for the Cayley-Lagrangian. In hydrodynamics, your right degrees of freedom are the conserved charge densities in the game. So if I have a global conserved current, my hydrodynamic variable is the zeroth component of that current, the charge density. The conserved current, so I have a conservation law. That's why I'm one equation of motion. And then in order to solve for the full dynamics of this rho, all I need is write down some expression for Ji, the spatial component of that current. Now I play my low energy effective game where I say, well, it's got to be rotation invariant. So I have a Ji here. I want to have as little derivatives as possible. So I need at least one derivative di of rho here. That's the only one derivative term I can write. I put some coefficient out front. That thing I call the diffusion constant. At the level of low-energy effective theory, that is undetermined, but of course, that is where the microscopic physics then feeds in. So if I understand the full microscopic physics, I can do a matching calculation. I calculate the two-point function in low-energy effective theory, calculate the two-point function in the full microscopic theory. That gives me these Pupo formulas. Now, I stole them from a paper by Arnold Moore and Jaffe. Here, if you look at the diffusion constant, they even allow for more than one conserved charge. So alpha, beta labels the various conserved charges. You see that this diffusion constant can be given by a current-current two-point function. So if I understand my full microscopic physics, I can calculate all those things. And that's, ADS-CFT provides me examples of theories. We can actually do this calculation on the right-hand side. But from the low-energy effective point of view, those constants, the transport coefficients, or the viscosities, conductivities and diffusion constants, those are undetermined, and you need the correlation functions in microscopic theory in order to get them out. So still you can ask your question, what good does a toy model do me? So I have this toy model where I can calculate all these correlation functions in the microscopic theory. But from the point of view of calculating actually something in QCD or in any other strongly coupled non-equilibrium system you care about, you already have hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics works. That's a right low energy effective description. And all you need are these transport coefficients, which you can happily take from data. So now we have a toy model in which you can calculate these transport coefficients, but they'll give you different answers because it's a different theory. So what did I really gain? I knew to begin with, what are the right equations of motion up to a few undetermined constants? Now I can determine those constants, but in the wrong theory. Does this really buy me anything? And of course I'm going to try to convince you that it's really a cool thing to have this solvable toy model. Now ADS-CFT is doing something great for to get new insights in non-equilibrium dynamics of strongly coupled systems. And I grouped the applications that have been uncovered in the course of the mainly last 1, 2, 3 years into 3 different qualitative groups. The one is you can test the hydrodynamic formalism. You can test this low energy effective formalism. Now, these are various results that have been obtained that you didn't need ADS-CFT for. Now, if you just sit down and do your most general expansion and derivatives, write down all the terms allowed with symmetry, you can get all about hydrodynamics. You don't need ADS-CFT. But there were various things which were very confusing until somebody did the ADS-CFT calculation to see what those terms actually are in this one particular example. Then later you can go back and say, oh, yeah, I could have done this also had I been more careful about how my expansion really works. So I'll talk about 2 examples briefly here, and we'll have talked about this afternoon, so I'll just briefly touch on this. The other thing ADS-CFT toy examples can do for me is they can give me quantitative guidance. Now, while I shouldn't take the values I get out of ADS-CFT seriously because it's a wrong system for anything you measure in the laboratory, at least can you give you some idea of what are typical values to get for certain transport coefficients in a strongly coupled series? Are there some sort of limiting values? And here a bunch of examples. I'll talk mostly about one of them actually. And the last thing these toy examples can do for you is they can identify new dynamical mechanisms. So yes, and from the point of view of the low energy effective theory, all the information about the microscopic physics is hidden in those few handful of transport coefficients. But the microscopic dynamics that gives rise to those transport coefficients is very different at recoupling and strong coupling. And these toy models, they exhibit certain dynamical mechanisms which you hadn't seen before. They might inform how to model strongly coupled non-equilibrium dynamics. And I'll talk about 2 examples here. And some of this will involve recent work with myself and my collaborators about energy loss of frogs moving through a hot plasma or jets at zero temperature. Which then hopefully will help to inform not just Rick but also LHC physics. Right, so that's the outline of my talk. I want to try to describe briefly to you work done mostly by others on examples where ADS-CFT helped to refine the hydrodynamic formalism, examples where ADS-CFT gave us quantitative guidance, and I'll discuss both examples and limitations, things where people calculate ADS-CFT quantities and it's clear that you should not take the numbers seriously. Then after having reviewed what happened in the last year, I'll actually talk a little bit about how do you do these calculations and what is the mechanics of ADS-CFT, give you a 4-slide crash course in ADS-CFT, just to set the stage for the talks, for the remainder of my talk and for the talks that will come later today, where people actually do a lot of ADS-CFT calculations for you. And then last but not least, I want to talk about this recent work of myself with Paul Chesler and Christian Jensen, which goes into this category of identifying new dynamical effects that are visible at strong coupling. All right, the new refinements of the hydrodynamic formalism. There are 2 examples that I want to talk about, second order hydro and 2+1 hydro in the background magnetic field. And again, you'll hear more about both of those later this afternoon, so this is just going to be some trying to put this into context, trying to tell you where things, how things fit together. So if you look at hydrodynamics, you get a very similar low energy effective theory for the stress energy tensor. You just expand it out and write down all zeros and first order terms in the derivative expansion consistent with the symmetry of the system. And that basically gives you a Navier-Stokes equation. But you can worry about what is the structure of the second order terms. So I went out to 1 derivative already. Now you want to go out to 2 derivatives, and it's clear what your strategy should be. You just enumerate all terms consistent with symmetry, write them down, put a new undetermined transport coefficient in terms of every new tensor structure. There are really, really a lot. So you make this work a little bit easier by specializing to a more symmetric case. You say, well, let's first do this for conformal hydrodynamics. Let's just forget about enumerating all possible terms all terms consistent with rotational symmetry. Let me write down all terms that are actually consistent with only this more limited symmetry group. I want to look at the conformal scale invariant fluid, ask myself what are all the second order terms that are there. This is an interesting task because of a problem of the first order hydro. Now, if I look at the dispersion relations in first order hydros, there are some modes that diffuse So now we're talking about hydrodynamics. This diffusion constant is basically the viscosity. And in this, in hydrodynamics, we have some modes which have a dispersion relation omega goes as k squared, the typical diffusion equation. But if you look at this, what you find is that the group velocity, the omega by decay, at large k diverges because now I take one derivative, brings my k squared down to k, that still goes to infinity as I send k to infinity. It's of course not really a problem because I'm writing down a low energy effective theory. I shouldn't trust my hydrodynamics at large k. So who cares what's happening to large k? Well, a computer cares. Now, if you try to put Navier-Stokes equations on a computer, you'll find that in relativistic Navier-Stokes equations, you get big problems because of that. You have to tell your computer something what happens at short distances. Now, you know you shouldn't trust your code down there, but the computer still needs to do something with the fluid. And people saw big instabilities because of this acausality that's come about with this short wavelength mode. And then the idea was that, well, maybe second-order hydrodynamics corrects this from all alone. So let's include one more correction. Go one order deeper into the derivative expansion, go out to two derivative order, and then hopefully all those problems will go away. And what's the basic idea behind this Müller-Israeli-Stewart approach, where what they do is instead of adding the most general second order term, they just add one particular second order term, which indeed made the V finite at short distances and smaller than the speed of light, so everybody was happy. What has recently emerged is the inside of this Müller-Israeli-Stewart term, even though it's allowed, is inconsistent with the conformal invariance. So the particular term you chose was not a very smart one if you want to model a conformal invariant fluid. Now, whether the QCD fluid at Wick is well approximated by conformal fluid or not, I don't really know, but there's some indication that it is. And so it might be better, instead of using this Müller-Israeli-Stewart term, to use some second-order terms that are consistent with conformal invariance. So if you actually use conformal invariance, you find that there are five different second-order terms allowed, which it does not include this Müller-Israeli-Stewart term. And they have been first calculated in ADS-CFT examples. So people sat down in ADS-CFT, calculated the stress tensor to second order, and there were two groups that actually did this. And they find a lot of terms, and then later they go back and say, oh yeah, we could have done this to begin with using the hydrodynamic formalism. Here are five different tensor structures consistent with conformal invariance. I knew that only those five can show up. And in one particular example in ADCFT, I can actually give you the value of those coefficients. But in general, you probably wouldn't want to pay much attention to the values, but at least you want to know what are the right tensor structures. And for conformal invariant fluid, now we know them, and we didn't know them before. And by now, some hydrodynamic simulations actually use already this new tensor structure, as you heard about from Uli Heinz recently. It's only some. So the Seattle-based hydrodynamic code uses the new insights from ADCFT. The other example where people did make use of ADS-CFT to just get the hydrodynamic formalism itself straight is the Nernst effect. What is the Nernst effect? The Nernst effect is telling you in some materials, if you have a temperature gradient, you get the temperature gradient induces a voltage or electric current perpendicular to the temperature gradient. It's something people got really excited about very recently again. As you can see, it's like 100-year-old or more than 100-year-old physics probably, but people write articles in Nature about this these days. The main reason is that in high TC superconductors, this really mysterious material, this Nernst effect is pretty large. So people think that the Nernst effect might give us some clues in understanding high TC superconductors better. Good. Thank you. I do. So temperature gradients drive electric current. Yes, and there's a magnetic field in there. Correct. But you can summarize the Nernst effect together with other transport coefficients you might have in the same system. If you have temperature gradients, you would expect heat current. If you have electric current, you would have thought an electric field was driving all this. You can write this all in this 2x2 matrix of transport coefficients, a conductivity which tells me electric fields give me currents, a heat conductivity which tells me temperature gradients give me thermal currents, and then these off-diagonal terms where up here I have the Nernst coefficient which is telling me that the electric current comes about from the temperature gradient. And people calculated this in a particular example in ADS-CFT, and the most interesting claim, the claim I want to talk about in this little introduction today came out of this Hartmann-Herzog paper, where they basically tell you that if you know sigma, if you know the conductivity as a function of omega, so for time-dependent electric fields, and it's even a complex function because there's a phase in there that's important too. So once you know this complex function sigma of omega, then you can determine both alpha and kappa. The other two transport coefficients are uniquely determined in terms of sigma. And that's basically additional insight, which then later has been claimed to be true generally. No, you didn't need ADCFT again. No, the hope is that you. But this is promised to be published soon, and I haven't seen the paper yet. So, but the claim is that this relation between sigma, alpha, and kappa, it just follows from very general symmetry principles. Just follows from hydrodynamics. You don't need ADCFT for this relation, but it was sure helpful to have the realization of the system in this toy model that people came up with the actual formulas that relate alpha and kappa to this conductivity sigma. And then presumably you can all soon have water identity written down that will derive this in all generality. So that was a really important hydro result that was obtained by studying this one particular example, ADCFT realization of that system. In addition, ADCFT then also provides for you, a full functional form of sigma in that particular toy system. Well, is this useful or not? That brings me to my next topic, What does ADCFT do for you in addition to refining the hydrodynamic formalism, giving you things that hydrodynamics alone could have told you, but you weren't smart enough to listen to? It can give you sometimes quantitative guidance. Sometimes you want to take this value for the transport coefficients literally, at least at some, either as a limiting value or as a typical value. And the most exciting example, or the most well-known example of this, is called eta over s. People calculated eta over s in a lot of hydrodynamic examples. First it was done in Engels, forces, Young, Mills, later in other systems, and you get this eta over s is 1 over 4 pi. If you look how this was done, you can phrase it as calculating graviton absorption cross-section by a black hole in anti-de Sitter space, and then later suggested to those authors that this is actually a bound. Because you're basically saying the cross-section of a black hole is the area of the black hole, so the viscosity is going to be proportional to the cross-section of the black hole. Then you ask how much entropy can you put into this area, and then the typical argument about black holes is a black hole is the largest thing that you can put into that area, the thing with the most entropy you can stuff in there. So for a given viscosity, which means a given cross-section for your graviton to be absorbed, the black hole is the most entropy you can stuff into that area. So you expect if you calculate eta over s for a black hole, you get, at least in this year, if you have a gravitational dual, you get something like the maximum value of eta over s. And that's basically in gravitational fields, it has been proven, but we don't know how general class that is. So at least it has been conjectured that eta over s of 1 over 4 pi is a bound, the most perfect fluid. And no matter what the status of this bound is, this value certainly has appeared as a benchmark for Rigg. You can no longer go to a Rigg talk and not see eta over s as being 1 over 4 pi. That's a number that is guiding people's thinking. And that's the kind of thing you can hope to get out of toy models. Get some benchmarks. What is the typical value? What is the limiting value? What is some result you can compare your experiments to? Just so you can draw lines in the diagrams with some numbers, give people some idea of where they are. Am I close to that bound? Am I above? Am I below? And so far, nobody has found a substance which violates this bound. So it's still okay to think that this is a true statement so far from all you know. And the reason why this is such a famous and such a important quantity that came out of ADCFT, it was independent of all the details of my gravitational dual. Doesn't matter what is the actual value of the coupling, what is the particular example I'm working with, in which dimension am I working with. So it's completely universal among those class of toy models which I can solve using this technique. The similar universality has been reported for a few other quantities. I won't go through this in detail, current correlators in 2 plus 1D, relaxation time of certain non-hydro modes, and later today we'll hear something about ratio of central charges defined in 2 different ways. There are a lot of quantities which are like eta over s. They are independent of a large class of toy models. You might think the actual values will teach you something. They are certainly typical values. In order to understand this a little bit better, what do I mean by independent of the coupling? I first wanted to give you 2-3 slides about the meaning of the coupling in ADCFT, and then we'll soon talk about things which you can calculate in ADCFT which are not nearly as universal, and try to see whether we can make some sense out of those things. So why do I have a coupling? What is the role of the coupling constant in all of this? Didn't I tell you that I'm strong coupling, so why do I actually care about what the coupling constant precisely is? All tractable examples of the gauge gravity duality of ADS-CFT actually come with a large dimensionless parameter intrinsically, you can really say a small intrinsic parameter, but people like to call it large. 1 over large numbers is small numbers. These ADS-CFT examples they are not strongly coupled in the sense of that all couplings are order 1. They all have a small number in there. If it weren't for that small number, you couldn't calculate anything. It's 1 over a marginal coupling in n equals 4 to the r. If you look at the confining examples, series with a mass gap for which we have a gravitational dual, it's something like the ratio of a flux tube tension to the mass gap. Now, these series are a lot like QCD. They have flux tubes out of non-abelian electric flux. They have a mass gap in their spectrum. And in QCD, you would expect all those scales to be basically the same. Something that has a gravity dual, you need the flux tube tension to be much, much larger than the mass gap squared. And all of the examples, in addition, have something like a number of colors, which is large. So there are some small parameters hiding in there. Otherwise, you couldn't do ADS-50. Why? It's basically because string theories don't do that job. String theories are too lazy to do string theory. They want to calculate in classical gravity. And you need a small parameter in order to approximate your string theory by classical gravity. What's common to all the theories which we have assembled so far, where we can solve the strong coupling dynamics of the theory using ADS-CFT, we all only want to do Einstein-Hilbert gravity on the bulk, coupled to some matter, and that matter also better be truncated down to two derivatives so we know what we're doing. So these theories, this is not a good quantum theory. We didn't suddenly get great insights into how to make Einstein-Hilbert theory consistent quantum gravity without strings. It's just we want to use classical Einstein-Hilbert theory, so we somehow have to push off the scale of UV completion of basically the string scale to energy scales, which are much, much larger than the typical energy scales you study in Einstein gravity, which is one over your curvature radius. And that's why you're stuck having this large parameter around, or not, this intrinsically small number. In this most studied example, n equals 4 to the Mills, you have even two of those small parameters. You have this tough coupling lambda, and you have the large number of colors n. And that's because there are actually two new scales in the game on top of the typical energy scales, one over the curvature radius of this space you're looking at. But from the field theory point of view, the typical energy scales which you want to study, there's one high scale, the flux tube tension, which goes with a power of lambda quarter up. And then you have the Planck scale, the scale where naively gravity became strong, which goes up by some power of n. And then in the weakly coupled strings here, this scale is smaller than that one. So the UV completion of this gravity in the bulk actually is given by type 2B strings here in 85 times 5 by some strings here. There, all you would have to do is study strings on that space, but we don't really know how to do that yet. So we want to keep this lambda large in order to do any sort of calculation. So what this means in terms of universal versus non-universal quantities, well, first of all, you can ask yourself, is there something that's common among all series which do have a gravitational dual? All the series where I introduce by hand a small parameter that separates my UV completion from my gravity scale. And that's these, like eta over s, these universal results which I told you about before. These are all results that are common to any theory which is, completely determined by, whose dynamics is completely given by Einstein gravity. And I think later today you'll hear a talk where this will be called universality without symmetry. There's a huge class of theories which all have in common this one big parameter which separates the UV completion from classical gravity, and they'll have shared certain properties. But even though in the class of those series, there are certain quantities which actually do depend on details. No, it's not like they're all the same. In particular, there are certain quantities which do depend on the actual value of lambda and n. You need this to be a large quantity so you can calculate classical gravity. But there are many transport coefficients where actually lambda and n themselves do appear. One example would be the viscosity alone. Why do people always quote for you eta over s? Well, because if you calculate eta itself, it scales like n squared. If you want to compare eta of n equals 4 to the Mills to the eta of QCD, you first have to pick a value of n. Or you can phrase it the other way around. For any viscosity somebody gives you, you can find some n so that it's going to work. So it's this one parameter in, one prediction out sort of scenario. So that's why often people don't get as excited about these non-universal quantities, where you do actually have to commit to a value of n and lambda, even though it needs to be large so you can use ADS-CFT, but you do have to plug in some numbers. And the other examples of this are these quantities which have been talked about a lot in the last year, the drag experienced by a heavy quark, the jet quenching parameter, and all those, they scale as a square root of lambda. So in many ways, they're in the same class. You have one piece of data that you give me from the Rick experiment where you can calculate heavy quark drag, say a jet quenching parameter, and I can give you the value of root lambda for which I can predict that number. One parameter in, one prediction out, it's a theory that's always right. So for a given plasma, you want to have some idea. If you want to use some of these non-universal data points as some sort of quantitative guide for the experiment, you do want to have some idea whether you can trust your toy model or not. if I have this one parameter family of toy models labeled by lambda, which one of those should I trust? They all give me different answers. If I want to get any quantitative guidance for my experiment, I should have some sort of method to decide which one is a good toy model, which one is a bad toy model, and get some, at least, ability to judge the accuracy, you know, how large are the errors we are making. And there's been, you know, some work I've been doing with Dong Su Park and Larry Yaffe will at least give you some way of classifying this. This is all based on insights people got from week-to-week comparisons. There's a whole series of papers written by the usual suspects. Now, I hope I have everybody in the room who worked on this, but there's a whole group of people who did studies of week-week comparison, meaning you take this toy model system, n equals 4 zero mills, you calculate it weak coupling, you compare it to QCD at weak coupling. So that should give you some insights of how good is a toy model at capturing QCD. And then what people find is the toy model is a good toy model for QCD if you make sure that the long distance properties are the same. That sounds like a redundancy. You know, I want to have a model that has the same long distance dynamics as two models with the same long distance dynamics. So all I need to do is make sure that long distance dynamics agrees and I'm fine. But it's different. There's some real content in here because what you're looking at, what those people find is what you need to make sure is that the long distance correlation function of equilibrium fluctuations agree. You go into equilibrium, you say calculate a current-current, real space current-current correlator. You look at the exponential falloff of that current correlator. That defines some really important mass scales of this equilibrium system for you. You know, in a weakly coupled system, this would be the Debye screening length, the length where electric charge gets exponentially screened, and then the mass gap, the typical falloff of a generic correlator. Recoupling, these are two very different scales, it's e t here and d squared t there. That's no non-perturbative, something you can get in perturbations here. But there are these other scales in the system. If you make sure that in two weakly coupled systems, in equilibrium, those two mass scales more or less agree, then you find that the hydrodynamic properties, the non-equilibrium transport coefficients, also agree. So this gives you some sort of at least a quantitative guide of distinguishing good toy models from bad toy models. Good toy models are toy models which have similar values for m-gap and m-debye than the model you're really interested in. And since this is now equilibrium properties, it's something you can actually calculate. In QCD, we do know those numbers even at strong coupling. It's something you can do on the lattice. The equilibrium physics, not real-time physics. You go to the lattice, you ask your friends on the lattice, or you look up their paper. You know, what is the Debye mass? What is the gap in QCD close to the transition temperature? And then this gives you a way to systematically look for a perfect ADCFT dual, something that matches those two numbers. So let's go to the one really, the most popular ADS-CFT model, n equals 4 at infinite coupling. Now, what is the gap? What is the Debye mass? First, you need to define it. So the gap is the falloff of a generic correlator. Arnold and Yaffe gave a non-perturbative definition of what the Debye mass should be. It should be the falloff of a generic CT odd correlator. And then you go ahead on the lattice, you find that close to TC, you get that the gap and the Debye mass are just some pure numbers times the temperature, and the numbers are 4 and 6 in QCD. N equals 4 at infinite coupling is 7 and 11. You can get excited for a little bit that the ratio is 1.5 in both cases. But in the end, you really see the main lesson you learn is this is off by about 100%. So anything you calculate in N equals 4 zero mill at infinite coupling, you should take with a grain of salt. You should expect that's a model that's good to within a factor of 2. If you want to get quantitative guidance out of N equals 4 zero mills, the errors you should expect are of the order 100%. It gives you a strategy. It gives you a strategy how to look for better duals. Now, if you want to model QCD, just take your favorite supergravity dual and try to calculate what are the Debye mass and the gap. For Witten's black hole is 6 and T. Still not quite there, but there are more. And Larry Yaffe and his student Steve Peck, they're right now in the process of trying to calculate all those quantities in a variety of solutions. It's only become recently possible because Alex Buchel with various collaborators worked out numerically what are these black hole solutions. Now, for most of these gravity duals, we didn't know how to study them at finite temperature. That knowledge is slowly emerging. You get more and more handle on finite temperature plasmas other than the n equals 4. And hopefully we'll find something that matches QCD even better than n equals 4 zero mills. Right, so how do I do any of these calculations? Now halfway in my talk, I wanted to actually give you an ADS-CFT crash course so I can set the stage for the talks which actually report about all these results, which I try to put into context for you. And also my own results, you'll be able to talk about once I told you a little bit about ADS-CFT. So I do this in 4 or 5 transparency, so don't expect too much. No, ADS-CFT, so I told you I have a gravitational theory that's dual to the field theory. Well, how does this gravitational theory look like? If I want to do gravity, the thing I need is a metric. I have this anti-de Sitter space. And here's the, what I always find the most useful cartoon of anti-de Sitter space. It has a boundary up here. So this is where the field theory lives. And then it has like this gravitational well where everything wants to fall down. And if you study this at finite temperature, there would be a finite temperature black hole horizon down there. If it, you do this at zero temperature, then basically things can fall forever. Or you can, if you bring in your infinity by rescaling, then there's some. Also, something like a horizon down here, but it doesn't have any temperature. And the relevant degrees of freedom, the bulk are closed strings, which we approximate by gravitons. So my large N from before is telling me these loops are really, really tiny. I want to go to a limit where the typical size of those loops is so small that I can treat them as point-like gravitons. Those closed strings, they fall. And what is falling of those closed strings corresponds to is that in the 4D field theory, you started with a very narrow flux tube. And that narrow flux tube keeps spreading and spreading and spreading. So falling in the bulk corresponds to spreading out on the field theory side. And the simplest example where I really do anti-de Sitter space in the bulk, I end up with a theory which is conformal. It has 1 over r potentials, like just like electromagnetism. Basically, because these flux tubes can spread out to arbitrary big sizes, I don't get linear potentials like in a confining theory, but I get 1 over r potentials like in electromagnetism. And E and M, I also have flux tubes, but they can spread out to arbitrary large sizes. At finite temperature, I draw the same picture, only now that this dashed line down there really is a black hole. That's a black hole horizon. Strings can fall to this black hole horizon. So now I'm describing conformal field theory at finite temperature or a confining theory at some temperature which is above the first order phase transition where I lost all the knowledge about my confining dynamics down here. And now falling is still spreading out in the field theory, meaning thermalizing. I have a very narrow localized object. It falls and falls and falls, spreads out until it reaches sizes of 1 over T, at which time it disappears in the black hole from the bulk point of view. From the field theory side, it got thermalized. And so thermal field theory is the dynamics of that black hole. The basic object to calculate an ADC via correlation function. So what do I get out of those nice pictures which I drew? There's a precise recipe which tells me if I calculate the on-shell action in the bulk, I get the generating functionals of the field series. I can get any correlation function I want, where the boundary value of the fields which I use in order to solve my equations of motion, which I then plug into the on-shell action, acts as a source for a dual operator. So for every field in the bulk, I get an operator at the boundary. Particularly, the metric in the bulk is dual to the stress energy tensor in the boundary. And then I need to make sure that the boundary value of my field gets identified as the source of the corresponding operator. So that's part of the dictionary, what operator goes with which field. And then this leads you to calculate position space Feynman diagrams in anti-de Sitter space. Because that's such a long word, people call it just quickly a Witten diagram. But it's just a good old-fashioned Feynman diagram in position space to get a two-point function out in the field theory. And that's the most interesting thing for all these Hydra applications where you want to stick things into Kubo formulas, you need two-point functions. To get a two-point function, all you basically need to do is a simple Green's function calculation. It's a Green's function in this curved space-time with a black hole in there. But once you've got the two-point function in the bulk, you don't have to calculate anything anymore. That's the answer. That's your two-point function in the field theory. And then you can just go ahead and stick it to your Cooper formula. So calculating Green's functions in the bulk gives me two-point functions. Getting higher point functions, you have to introduce interaction vertices. So these are 1 over n suppressed interaction vertices because I'm dealing with classical gravity. I sometimes know if I do higher point function, I will also use propagators which go from one source in the bulk to another source in the bulk. Propagators look much simpler if you insist your source is only being out in the boundary. So interactions are complicated. People did calculate four-point functions, but they did it once and then never looked back at it. Maybe it's time to revisit it. You don't need to do loops. You don't ever need to integrate over closed loops. You need to integrate over position of your vertices, but there are no loops. Loops will be 1 over nc suppressed, nc squared suppressed. So again, we're doing classical gravity. If you put additional sources in the bulk, as I'll soon do, some states in the system are well approximated by putting a classical source in this classical bulk. Then it's also interesting to calculate one-point functions. I would have a source and use one of those Green's functions to go up. So to be a player in the game of ADCFT, that's the one thing you need to know how to do. You need to calculate Green's function and curved metrics, and then you go and you can calculate any correlation function you want. One more thing, adding flavor. Now, all of these examples, strangling myself. All the examples that I showed you so far, they were basically about glue only. At large NC, there's a huge difference between matter and adjoint representations, matter in fundamental representations. Now, quarks are in the fundamental representations. You'd like to somehow make your bulk to know about fundamental representation objects. Fundamental representation objects, things that scale with n as opposed to n squared, they correspond to open strings in the bulk. So I need to introduce open strings into my bulk theory. And the way you do this, you introduce what we call a flavor brain. It's some object on which a string can end. So open strings only live with the endpoints on that flavor brain. And the feature these flavor brains have is that they cover some half of spacetime where, this direction, since falling was associated with spreading, you can associate any radial position in the spacetime with a certain energy scale, certain length scale, certain energy scale. And if you introduce a fundamental object, it will come with a mass. So heavy flavors will be the one which only cover the upper part of the space. Massless flavors will be the one which cover all of space. And in particular, in the simple examples, now when we talk about heavy or light flavors, there's one big difference whether the flavor brain ends somewhere on top of the horizon, in which case I get beasts like this, which can hang down from the flavor brain but never touch the horizon. Light flavors would be one which cover all of space and where the flavor brain disappears on the other side of the horizon. And then the open strings that live on the flavor brains would be mesons. Baryons are hard to see. Baryons are always hard to see at large and see. They would be solitons made out of those fields living on the flavor brain. People did some studies of baryons in these systems, but that's certainly not nearly as productive as so far as studying the meson. Right, so now I want to use this to go back to my third important application of ADCFT. Remember the two things I talked about already was, you can use ADCFT to fix up problems you had in the hydroformalism. You can use ADCFT to get quantitative guidance in some quantities, but not in others. Those which depend on N and lambda, have to be much more careful to take the numbers on face value. But what I try to convince you of is that at least they give you some idea of what are the relevant mechanisms at strong coupling. And the two examples that I want to talk about are jets in N equals 4 supernumerals, both it's finite and zero coupling. So this is old work I've been doing with Chris, John, Pablo, and Larry, and Goop. They also had a paper on this. There what we studied was heavy quarks at finite temperature. The heavy quarks means, as I just told you, I have this flavor brain which ends somewhere way above the horizon. So I can have a fundamental quark, which is the string ending on the flavor brain. It's hanging down into my hot plasma. I turn on a constant electric field that wants to make my quark move. And then if I balance my electric field just right so that the force that pulls the electric field along does just as much work as the heavy quark loses to the hot plasma by the heavy quark drag, by the momentum loss of the heavy quark experience at finite temperature, I can get a completely stationary solution where the string moves along at a constant speed. And I can from this extract the loss rate, which as promised scales the square root lambda. And I can get all excited about it because I got this loss rate. I can try to compare to experiments and fix my root lambda so I can agree with your data. What's much more insightful, I think, is kind of going back and asking, what did the solution really tell me about? What was the relevant mechanism by which I lost stress energy? And in order to see this, it's also very helpful to actually go out of the boundary and look, what is the one-point function now? What's the expectation value of the energy momentum density? Where does this momentum actually go? There's been some beautiful work by Paul Chesler and Larry Yaffe where they produced for you these pictures. What you have over here is the energy density. What you have over here is the energy flux in the plasma, in the wake in the plasma, left behind by this heavy quark moving through the plasma. So the heavy quark is sitting somewhere here. It's moving through this plasma. It's pushing some plasma ahead of itself. This guy is moving faster than the speed of sound, so it has some nice Mach cone behind it. It's not a sharp shock wave because you have finite temperature. There's some viscosity in here. You see this nice smoothed out version, but it's still very clear there's some Mach cone. There's some diffusion wake behind it. The energy flows in from here, flows out there. The beautiful pictures, and you can see what's going on. Where does the energy go? The main lesson those authors drew from this is that hydro really works well. If you go in and draw the same picture purely based on hydrodynamics, you do see this naive expectation that it scales a little larger than temperature. And it's really surprising how close you can go to length scales of close to 1/T. This picture agrees beautifully with just the simple-minded hydrodynamic expansion you would get. The other thing you can get out of this picture is kind of go in and ask, how would I compare to this with the typical language people use about energy loss? How is my energy being lost? At weak coupling, often you see, depends on how fast your quark is moving, but sometimes you see that your energy loss would be dominated by single gluon bremsstrahlung, where a single gluon that gets emitted would carry a huge fraction of the energy, which is certainly not what you see here. You see this completely smooth cloud, no sort of point-like structure. There's no single gluon carrying a lot of energy. Basically, what you're seeing is like an infinite number of arbitrarily soft gluons carrying away all your energy. It's also not glue ball emission. You kind of knew this is already guaranteed by large N. So at strong coupling, we would call this, or we did call this, coherent gluon emission. Now it seems to be a lot of very soft gluons get emitted smoothly from this quark. All right, so you can ask two obvious questions. Now, how about light flavors, and how about jets at zero temperature? Now, people usually don't phrase zero temperature jets in terms of an energy loss rate, but at zero temperature, jets do exactly the same. As they move along, they emit gluons. They, instead of having single particle flying along a line, you have a cloud of stuff that hits your detector. And so zero temperature jets are also something you can study with this method, because you can also ask, what is the mechanism that produces the jets in the strongly coupled series? That's some questions that Christian and Paul and I are addressing currently, and we have basically, believe we have a picture by now that's quite coherent. But this is how a jet looks like at zero temperature for a massless quark. Now my quark is massless, my flavor brain is everywhere, so I don't draw it anymore for you. Nothing is holding the string endpoints up, they just can keep on falling. Produce a quark anti-quark pair at some early times, so I shoot out my two ends. And you see in many, many numeric runs, what they do is they very quickly settle on to two linear trajectories. Now this is the theory, conformal theory. There's no potential that holds the quarks together. They have a 1 over r potential. Give them enough energy, they just fly off infinitely into both directions, and they settle on this linear geodesics. It's basically given by one parameter, alpha squared plus beta squared got to be 1. Those things move at the speed of light. So the only parameter that's sitting in here giving me the shape of this configuration is the slope of those lines, and basically more or less independent of what you do with the initial conditions, as long as you give the quarks enough energy that they leave their potential value, you don't get a bound state, they very quickly settle onto these linear trajectories which then fall forever. Using this coordinate system, where at zero temperature I don't have a horizon, I get a linear trajectory that keeps on falling forever on both sides. So the picture you would want to associate with this at zero temperature is exactly what a jet should look like at the LHC. Now that's the kind of thing people see at in the accelerators. Out comes a quark anti-quark pair, but what you see in your detector is not a single quark hitting you, but you see a cloud of energy and charge density hitting you, which as the quark flies toward my detector, it's spread. No, I get a cloud of energy density and charge density. Now, in a confining theory, eventually this would break up into a bunch of hadrons. In my conformal field theory, it will just always remain this nice, smooth cloud of energy and stress density flying out and spreading.
Falling down
means spreading. And the endpoints fly sideways. That's why the blobs fly sideways. But at the same time, they fall. So that's why they spread. If you look at the heavy quark that was stuck at the flavor brain, it was just moving sideways, not falling. So the heavy quark also has some intrinsic structure, so I get a cloud of charge density that represents my heavy quark. But that doesn't spread anymore. That's nice and confined to its 1 over mass size, and it's just flying. There's those guys, they fall, so they spread at the same time as they're flying. You can process that information. Now here's another one of the string configurations, again, just trying to bring home this point that I get this universal endpoint behavior. This is there are basically only two parameters that parameterize how my jet looks like. There's an angle at which it's flying in the x or the c direction, so how fast does it move compared to how fast does it spread. And there's a total energy in the jet, which you just dial by where, at what height do you start your jet. If you wonder about what is this angle in the field theory, it's basically what people call the jet mass. So these quarks don't have to be on shell. The energy over momentum doesn't have to be, E doesn't have to be equal to P, but it can be any number. It's basically directly related to this velocity in the x direction. So I parameterize my velocity by how much velocity do I have in the x direction. The velocity in the c direction then is given because the total velocity is the speed of light. And I get a non-unity ratio between E and P as soon as I make this velocity anything different than 1. And so to see that you really get something like a jet, I can, for example, plot for you the baryon number density as a function of angle in the cone. I get pictures like this. Now my baryon number is strongly localized within that cone and has some nice fall off away from the central region or for a geodesic. So if I ignore this initial moment where my strings got created, which is non-universal, I get this 1 over, get a analytic expression for the fall off of this density. It's a very good approximation also for the full numeric solution which we generated. At finite temperature, you get something like this. The string crashes into the horizon. It doesn't fall forever. It stops at a finite distance. That's where my quark then, it moves for a little bit and then thermalizes, doesn't keep on moving anymore. get a late time behavior. You can analyze the number that's sitting there and see that it completely agrees with the time scales people found from quasi-normal modes analysis, small fluctuations around this plasma. Early times, I get something that looks like zero temperature. I'm mostly telling you this because now I'm going to show you a movie just to basically finish my talk about how one of those jets looks like at finite temperature, and it has both things in there. It has in there the jet character at early times, and it has in there the diffusion and thermalization at late times. Down here, that's my string. Now it's kind of falling down. The black stuff, that's really a black hole. You see here, you know, very well-known VR phenomenon that, you know, if something falls to the black hole using time of the boundary observer, you'll never see the string disappear in finite time. It looks like it's spreading out flat against the horizon. It's really keeps on falling, just, you know, ever slower from the point of view of the boundary observer. That's not early times. That's how a zero-temperature jet would look like. So I'm plotting for here your baryon number density. The baryon number density flies and spreads. And now, at some point, the endpoint suddenly gets pulled in by the black hole. That's thermalization. Now, suddenly, my jet knows it's a finite temperature. And instead of just nicely jetting along, the charge density just gets suddenly diffused away. So we start with a jet which has an energy like 30 T or something like this. So it kind of jets along till the typical energy scales in the jet are of order temperature, and then it starts suddenly to diffuse. All right, what I want to learn from this is that at strong coupling, this is how a jet looks like. And it's again this coherent emission of soft radiation. You radiate an infinite number of infinitely soft photons, gluons. And you might wonder whether this may be providing for you a good way of model jets at LHC as well, because what you're using right now is the Enthusia flux tubes breaking. That's certainly very much against the 1 over n spin spirit. Now, at weak coupling, we get emission of several individual gluons. So maybe one can try to use it as some sort of input into new Monte Carlo tools that help you, you know, identify jets at the LHC, or go after the substructure of jets that help you distinguish physics from new physics from GCP jets. So I'm done. Now, I hope I convinced you in this talk that gauge gravity duality is a great toy model to study non-equilibrium phenomena at strong coupling. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the afternoon. We'll hear many, many more details about some of those examples.
Thank you very much. Questions?
That movie that you just showed, you said this was baryon number, so I guess your jets were quark jets.
Yeah, so this is like E plus E minus collider, and I produce a single quark, anti-quark flying out.
Can you also do gluon jets, and can you answer the question how they lose energy relative to quark jets? I mean, there is this, from Rick, this puzzle that somehow the gluon jets and the quark jets don't seem to be losing energy at different rates as predicted by perturbative Casimir operators. And so,
interesting. I should be able to do something that looks like a two gluon event where I take a close. No, gluons are closed strings, that's why it's a little harder. But then single gluons should be something like folded strings. So there are analytic solutions known to the closed string equation where you have a closed string that looks like two open strings glued together. So I would expect that I can get closed strings which look a little bit like this. But certainly something which we haven't even started looking at so far at all. Yes, I thank you. Thank you for that.
When you talked about the Nernst effect in the beginning, so this sigma of omega, that's really a complete function. I mean, that is way, goes way beyond hydrodynamics, right?
How large of an omega do you want to trust this hydrodynamics?
That's my question. I mean, how far can you go? I mean, can you really determine it for all omega, or?
In ADCFT, knows more than just hydrodynamics. So in ADCFT, you can certainly calculate sigma of omega for all omega, as long as it's not parametrically large in root lambda. So if you make your lambda and your NC large enough, you can make sigma omega correct for all omegas you want. But of course, you wouldn't want to use the sigma omega anymore for hydrodynamics description if you go to, you know, high enough omega compared to T. So, you know, this application of saying, you know, in hydrodynamics, and it is the relations, you know, I referred to, which I didn't even show you, but the ones, you know, Chris and Jean worked out, those are satisfied by the full sigma omega, full alpha of omega, full kappa of omega, not just in the hydrodynamics issue, but no, you wouldn't probably want to use Cooper formulas anymore to calculate it.
Okay, again. In the context of these Mach cone pictures, you said that you interpreted the results as evidence for coherent gluon emission. How do you know that? I mean, how do you know you have gluons in Strock coupling at all? And not
I
some
can just tell you what I don't have, right? I don't have blue ball emission because I know what my source is doing. There's no string breaking. I didn't allow it to break. I don't see any grainy structure where I would think, no, there's a few single events that came, single things that got emitted. And I see this nice, smooth picture of a plasma wake. So that's, no, maybe it's a wrong word. Tell me a better word. But no, that was what I was trying to capture by some sort of way. Yes.
How would you ever see graininess if you're really basically looking at a two-point function or a one-point function? Don't you have to look at higher point functions to know whether something's grainy?
Well, this is a full expectation. But by construction basis, I don't allow my... I would have to study, you know, how likely is my source to fluctuate, and can estimate that that's down by factors of 1 over root lambda. If you know the full density out at the boundary, you can just stare at it and see that there's no graininess in there. As a function of time. Yeah, I know you. Yes, I'm looking at the one-point function. It would be very informative to have higher point functions. But I think by just staring at that, you already know, can see that there's no structure.
Non-grainy profile.
I'm guaranteed to have a smooth profile by putting enough energy into my string so I can know. To describe this energy loss by a classical string moving in this classical gravity background, you need two things to be classical, both the gravity and the string. The gravity is classical because I dialed my n's and my lambdas to be large, and my string is classical because I dialed my energy to be, you know, root lambda times the typical scales of my gravitation theory. And then you can see for those strings, no, we're basically, I have a string that's large compared to its tension, and then fluctuations of the string are suppressed by that very virtue. That's the same reason why I see this very nice smooth picture, because, you know, like Brownian motion, that's something that we discussed a little bit. You don't see it all. Brownian motion is, you know, suppressed by exactly the same 1 over root lambda factor. Now, if you let this propagate for long enough, at some point, the small fluctuations of the string will have built up, and, you know, you can only trust this for timescales, which are not parametrically large in root lambda, but all these fluctuations are just suppressed by the virtue that I put enough energy into my jet.
So you told us about the efforts to find the perfect model for QCD, and you gave us two numbers. I mean, two numbers are certainly better than one number, but in what sense would that be a perfect description? I mean, certainly you have a restricted set of observables afterwards that you want to compute. For instance, if I go to very high temperature and I look what is the description in QCD for my low momentum modes, it's an effectively three-dimensional theory. It's again confining. It has a spatial string tension. You're not thinking about
these type of
questions.
When I say for QCD, I meant QCD in this almost conformal window very close to the transition temperature there. I can kind of think of it as a conformal theory, which was in this, if I look at the Debye mass and the gap in QCD, these are complicated functions of T, but there's some range over which they're linear. When I say they're just numbers, that's not already kind of, in QCD, I already limited myself to a small window where it's almost conforming, so that those mass scales are just a number times temperature and then compare the number. There are a few more numbers you can calculate. Now, in this spirit, the way Arnold and Jaffe defined the Debye mass as being the longest fall off, the longest correlation length in the CT odd channel, you can use other symmetry channels. Now, CT odd was just one they picked. There are a few more numbers you can, in our paper we have a handful of numbers, but it's not a proof that those agree, but it's this experience from the weak coupling calculations where people calculate a lot of transport coefficients in weakly coupled QCD, weakly coupled N equals 4, and find fairly good agreement if they just make sure that these equilibrium quantities agree, so it gives you some guidance. No, it, at least I think in the negative way you can certainly, if those two numbers differ by a factor of 2, you should not expect anything else in those two series. Now, any other long distance property in those series to agree to is better than within a factor of 2. And the recoupling experience suggests that if you make sure that the equilibrium properties agree, the long distance fall off of equilibrium correlators agrees, you get fairly good agreement about the long distance properties of the non-equilibrium fluctuations of these transport coefficients, like eta and diffusion constants. You have fairly good hope. you have a better motivated hope that you can actually quantitatively trust them as opposed to just qualitatively.
You might emphasize the qualitative things you mentioned, Jürgen, about high temperature properties having an effective long distance three-dimensional description with area law behavior of spatialism and loops. I mean, that's reproduced beautifully by these toy models. They capture that physics.
But if you have identified a n equals 4 supersymmetric theory which has optimal matching in the weak coupling limit to QCD, does that guarantee you that it's a good dual in the strong coupling limit?
No, so what was found at weak coupling was only the spirit, that what you should match are not coupling constants, but you should match physical length scales. This was, in some extent, the response to a lot of people not doing the exactly opposite. They say, well, in QCD at weak, I probably have alpha s equals to a half, so let me calculate lambda that corresponds to this, and then let me plug that lambda into my n equals 4 formula. That's certainly off, because if you do that at weak coupling, it's complete nonsense. From weak coupling, the lessons you want to extract from weak coupling, if you have two different microscopic descriptions, no, they're completely different as a microscopic theory, but they do exhibit similar long-distance behavior in non-equilibrium, as long as you made sure that you dialed whatever you can dial in such a way that in equilibrium the long-distance properties will agree. So you make sure long-distance properties in equilibrium are the same. That, at weak coupling, guarantees that long-distance properties out of equilibrium also are very similar.
Strategies would be to take these long-distance correlators, say, from lattice QCD,
yes,
and then find an n equals 4 strongly coupled theory,
yeah,
that has the same long-distance.
Right. So the lattice people are ahead of us, right? They have done their homework. There's still a little bit too big error bars. You would like those numbers to become a little bit more accurate, but there are numbers there from lattice QCD which we are shooting for. So now in the n equals 4 itself, you can only dial lambda or nc, but lambda is a little easier to dial, but it's still hard enough. Nobody knows the action, the higher derivative correction, so the type 2b action well enough to even calculate a subleading correction to the Debye mass. The type 2b supergravity doesn't get corrected at 4 or 6 derivatives. The first corrections come at 8 derivatives. Something is known about the 8 derivative interactions, but since it involves Ramond fields are not known well enough, and the Debye mass is a fluctuation of a Ramond scalar, and therefore we can't calculate the subleading lambda correction to that beast yet. But so instead of just dialing lambda in n equals 4 supergravity mills, what I advertise, what you might also do is look at other gravity duals. N equals 4 is just the first one, the best studied one. There are all these other things, n equals 2 star, Klebanov-Strassler, Witten's black hole. These are all kind of, they share the common feature that they have a formal limit in which they become QCD, but you cannot study it in that limit because then, the limit in which you can study is always where you artificially separate the flux tube tension from the mass gap. So they have one limit where the flux tube tension agrees with the mass gap, they are QCD. They have one limit where we can study it. But so a different microscopic series maybe have similar long distance properties. So it's more like a systematic way of going through a list of series and kind of checking which one comes closest to QCD.
You've said repeatedly that this approximation of conformal invariance near TC for a Rick collision is a good approximation. What's your justification for that?
maybe I should have put this more with a question mark. No, it's kind of listening to folks like the people sitting here that who use these conformal numbers to kind of with some sort of success. Certain features of QCD close to the phase transition, like the equation of state and the fact that the Debye mass and the gap are linear in temperature. But there are many aspects of QCD close to the phase transition that are clearly indicated of there being some sort of conformed structure.
The maximum violation of the trace anomaly, which is the violation of conformality, is right there between 1 TC and 2 TC.
Okay, when I mean close, it's more like between 2 and 5. Yeah. Like that.
Certainly wants to go above.
Thank you. So
on top of that, I would add that there's kind of quasi particle, probably a couple of quasi particles that work very well, about three times.
and read some logical factors into this thermodynamics. If you look at the degree of the
I just want to make a comment. So what you pointed out is that it's really dangerous to compare quantities which scale like n or root lambda. However, there is a way out of that, even for parameters like jet quenching. And I think a very fruitful thing to do is, so we can compute quantities like, for example, static quark, anti-quark potentials or things like that on a lattice. Something, but we also can compute things like that in ADI-CFT. On the other hand, on ADI-CFT, we can compute dynamical quantities, like, you know, again, jet quenching parameter or, you know, quark diffusion constant. And so it is always possible, I think, to find a corresponding equilibrium quantity that would scale in the same way as a non-equilibrium quantity. And then what you have to do, all you have to do is just, rather than presenting ADI-CFT data in terms of, you know, a number which is dependent on the model you look at, you present it as a ratio, sort of similar what has been done for eta over s. In those cases, all the square root dependence drops out. And then I would, first of all, what I see, if you look at a large class of non-conformal gauge series, if you present the data in this form, then you see a larger similarities, and, you know, sort of it's not exactly universal, but sort of within the same range of data. And that's also in some sense shown up in some things that you mentioned, right? If I look at M gap and M debye, if I look separately of them, they're way off. But if I look at the ratio, right, then they're nice, right? 1.5 in both cases. And so I see that it's not something that we cannot do, and we shouldn't, you know, be, you know, okay, it scales like root lambda, there is nothing we can do. I mean, I think we can, you know, we can say something useful for those cases as well.
Using equilibrium properties to, you know, get a handle on distinguishing good models from bad models is exactly the same philosophy I had, right? You say form ratios. Now, out of ratios, you always get less sensitivity to errors, but I think if you really want to have some guidance of how well do these numbers get reproduced by your model, you know, that the more honest thing is to kind of just look at the equilibrium properties really and say how much do they differ between the two series. You know. You see that the infinite lambda series just, you know, doesn't agree with equilibrium in the infinite lambda n equals 4 doesn't agree with equilibrium in QCD to better than within no factor of 2, which is quite good. No factor of 2 isn't that bad for a toy model.
So if there are no more questions, let's thank Andreas again. And back at 10:30.